glowing and inhuman. Drew wanted to reach out and snatch him back. "Jules?" he said, and his voice was small and low and stabbed into Drusilla's heart. She took a deep breath. If Tavi could approach them, so could she. She moved to stand behind her younger brother and tilted her shoulders back until she was looking directly up at Emma and Julian. It was like gazing into the sun. Her eyes prickled, but she held them open.
"Emma?"
she called.
"Julian? It's Drew. Drusilla. Look, everyone is telling you to stop because the battle is won, but I'm not here to say that. I'm here to tell you to stop because we love you. We need you. Come back to us."
Neither Emma nor Julian moved or changed expression. Drew plowed on, her cheeks burning.
"Don't leave us," she said. "Who will watch bad horror movies with me, Julian, if you're gone? Who will train with me, Emma, and show me everything I'm doing wrong, and how to be better?"
Something shifted behind Drew. Helen had come to stand beside her. She reached her hands out as if she could touch the shining figures before her.
"Julian," she said, "you raised our brothers and sisters when I could not. You sacrificed your childhood to keep our family together. And Emma, you guarded this family when I could not. If you both leave me now, how will I ever get a chance to make it up to you?"
Julian and Emma were still expressionless, but Emma tilted her head slightly, almost as if she was listening. Mark came forward, laying his slim hand on Drew's shoulder. He craned his head back.
"Julian," he called, "you showed me how to be part of a family again. Emma, you showed me how to be a friend when I had forgotten friendship. You gave me hope when I was lost."
He stood straight as an elf bolt, gazing into the sky.
"Come back to us."
Julian shifted. It was a minute movement, but Drew felt her heart leap. Maybe. Maybe. Ty stepped forward, his gear dusty and ripped where bark had torn it. His black hair fell in dark strands across his face. He pushed it away and said,
"We lost Livy. We lost her."
Tears stung the back of Drew's eyes. There was something about the tone of Ty's voice that made it sound as if this were the first time he had realized the finality and irrevocability of Livy's death. Ty's eyelashes shimmered with tears as he raised his gaze.
"We can't lose you too. We will wind up broken. Julian, you taught me what every word I didn't understand meant. And Emma, you chased off anybody who was ever mean to me. Who will teach me and protect me if you don't go back to being yourselves?"
There was a great, thundering crash. Julian had fallen to his knees. Drew covered a gasp. He seemed smaller than he had, though still enormous. She could see the black fissures in his glowing skin where red sparks of fire leaked out like blood. "There is a heavenly fire burning inside them. And no mortal being can survive that for very long."
"Emma,"
Drew whispered.
"Julian."
They weren't expressionless anymore. Drew had seen statues of mourning angels, of angels thrust through with fiery swords, weeping tears of agony. It was not easy to wield a sword for God. She could see those statues again in the looks on their faces.
"Emma!"
A cry burst from Christina, who had broken away from the others and came rushing toward the blackthorns.
"Emma! Who will be my best friend if you're not my best friend, Emma?"
She was crying, tears mixing with the blood and dirt on her face.
"Who will take care of my best friend when I cannot, Julian, if you are not there?"
Emma fell to her knees beside Julian. They were both weeping. Tears of fire, red and gold. Drew hoped desperately that it meant that they felt something, and not that they were dying, coming apart in twin blazes of fire.
"Who will drive me crazy with questions in the classroom if not you?" called Diana. She was coming toward them as well, and so were Kieran and Aline, leaving Gwyn holding Winspear's bridle, his face reflecting awe and wonder. Aline cleared her throat. "Emma and Julian," she said. "I don't know you that well. And this giant thing is admittedly a huge surprise." That wasn't a pun, I was being literal. She glanced sideways at Helen. "But being around you makes my wife really happy. And that's because she loves you both." She paused. "I also like you, and we're going to be a family, damn it, so come down here and be with this family." Helen patted Aline's shoulder.
"That was good, honey."
"Julian," Kieran said, "I could speak of the way Mark loves you, and Emma. I could speak of the friendship Christina bears you. But the truth is that I have to be king of the Unseelie court. And without your brilliance, Julian, and your bravery, Emma, I fear my reign will be brief."
In the distance, Drew could see Isabel and Simon approaching. Alec was with them, his arm around Magnus, and Clary and Jace walked beside them, hand in hand.
Tavi reached up his arms.
"Jules,"
he said, his small voice clear and ringing.
"Carry me. I'm tired. I want to go home."
Slowly as the passing of eons, Julian reached out with his bright hands, fissured with darkness from which heavenly fire poured like blood. He reached out toward Tavi. There was a burst of light that seared Drew's eyes. When she had blinked it away, she saw that Julian and Emma were no longer there. No, they had slumped to the ground. They were dark figures within an aura of light, growing ever smaller, surrounded by a pool of illumination, the color of bloody gold. For a terrified moment, Drew was sure they were dying. As the awful light faded, she saw Emma and Julian, human size again, crumpled together on the ground. They lay with their hands clasped together, their eyes closed, like angels who had fallen from heaven, and now slept peacefully upon the earth again.
Chapter 33, Reverence.
"Wake up, Emma. It's time to wake up." There was a gentle hand on her forehead, a gentle voice calling her out of the long dark. For some time, there had been only shadows. Shadows and cold after a long period of burning. The world had tilted at a distance. She had seen a place too bright to remember, and figures that shone like blades in the sun. She had heard voices calling her name. Emma. Emma. "Emma means universe," Julian had said. But she had not woken up. She had heard Julian's voice again, this time mixed with Jem's.
"It was a clever touch," Jem said, "having not one meeting but two. You knew any of the shadow hunters might be loyal to the cohort, so you had them attend only the first meeting. That way, when they reported to Horus what your plans were, he was prepared only for you to interrupt the parley, not for the downworlder attack."
"Jace and Clary agreed to be the bait," Julian said. He sounded tired, even in her dream. "We knew Horus would do anything to get his hands on them. That way, we could march them out in front of everyone and prove that Horus wasn't just wrong that they were dead. He was trying to kill them." There was a long pause. Emma floated in more darkness, though she could see shapes in it now, shapes and shadows. "I knew there would be spies at the meeting," Julian said. "I admit they surprised me by sending a demon. I didn't even figure it out until I saw the Eidolon on the battlefield. How do you think it got into the sanctuary? Just posing as Oscar Lindquist shouldn't have protected it."
"Demons have been known to use Shadowhunter blood to enter institutes. Oscar Lindquist was found dead yesterday. It is possible his blood was used. But would that grant the demon the power to be invulnerable to seraph blades? Julian said. There was a long pause.
I know of no magic strong enough for that. Jem sounded troubled. The Silent Brothers will want to know.
Emma dragged her eyes open reluctantly, not wanting to leave the softness of the dark.
Jem,
she whispered. Her throat and mouth were incredibly dry.
Emma.
She was pulled into a hug. Jem's arms were strong. She pressed her head into his shoulder. It was like being hugged by her father. A memory she kept always in the back of her mind, precious and unforgotten. She swallowed past the dryness in her throat.
Julian,
she whispered. Jem drew back. She was able to see where she was, in a small room with two white beds, a window in the wall letting in sunshine. Julian sat on the bed opposite hers, wearing a clean t-shirt and loose pants like training garments. Someone had put her into the same clothes. Her hair was tangled, and her whole body ached like a giant bruise. Julian looked unharmed. Their eyes met, and his expression softened. His back was straight and tense, his shoulders a hard line.
She wanted to go and hug him, at least to hold his hand.
She forced herself not to move. She felt fragile inside, her heart thundering with love and fear. She didn't trust herself to control her emotions.
You're in the Basilius, said Jem.
I woke you, Emma, after Julian had woken. I thought you would want to see each other. Emma looked around. Through a window in the wall, she could see a bigger room of white-sheeted cots, about half of which were taken up with patients. Silent Brothers moved along the rows, and the air smelled of healing, herbs and flowers, the medicines of the Silent City. Their room had a low-arched ceiling, painted with healing runes in gold and red and black. More windows faced out onto the buildings of Alicante, the red-roofed houses, the slim needles of the demon towers.
The children. Are they all right?
Emma said.
Helen?
I already asked, Julian said. It was hard for Emma to look away from him, and also painful to look at him. He seemed different somehow, changed. She tore her gaze free and stared at Jem, who had risen to stand by the window. Everyone's all right, Emma.
Even Kit? He saved my life.
He was quite drained and ill, said Jem. But he has recovered well. He is in the Silent City. We lost good warriors on the battlefield, but your friends are safe. You have been unconscious for 3 days, so you missed the funerals. But then, you've attended too many funerals lately as it is. Emma frowned.
But why is Kit in the Silent City? The Basilius?
Emma, Jem said, I did not come to you to talk about Kit. I came to talk about you and Julian. He pushed his hair back from his face. He looked tired, the white streak in his hair more pronounced. You asked me a long time ago about the Parabatai curse. What happens when two Parabatai fell in love? I told you what I knew, but I didn't dream you were asking for yourself.
Emma felt herself go still. She looked at Julian, who nodded.
He knows, Julian said in a flat sort of voice. Emma wondered what he was feeling. She couldn't quite read him, as she usually could, but they were likely both in shock. Everyone does now. Emma hugged her arms around herself.
But how?
I wish I had known, Jem said. Though I can understand why you did not tell me. I have spoken with Magnus. I know all that you did to try to combat the curse. No one could have struggled more. But this is not a curse that can be undone, save by the destruction of every Parabatai bond in all the world. He looked at Emma with sharp eyes, and she felt the sudden weight of how very old Jem was, and how much he knew about people. Or at least, that's what was believed, and every attempt to investigate the curse turned up no records of what might happen if the curse were to be realized. We only knew the symptoms. Increased power with runes, ability to do things no other Nephilim could do. The fact that you broke the mortal sword, Emma,
I am sure it was partly the strength of Cortana, and partly the power of the curse. But these were all things we only guessed at for many years. Then, the battle of 3 days ago happened. What of it do you remember?
Emma was dying in my arms, Julian said. His voice shook. It was strange, though. Normally, Emma would have felt a twinge inside her ribs, a flicker of his pain. Now, she didn't. There was a white light, and we were giants looking down. I don't feel what we felt, but I remember people looking like ants running around our feet, and feeling like we were on a mission, like we were being directed. I don't know how to explain it. Like we were being told what to do, and we had no choice except to do it.
As if something were working through you, said Jem. A will greater than yours.
Emma put her hands to her chest.
I remember now. Zara stabbed me. I was bleeding.
She remembered again the feeling of burning and the world spinning away and down.
We were giants? I need to tell you a piece of Nephilim history, said Jem,
though Emma wished he would stick more closely to the topic of giants. Had Emma and Julian turned into them?
Long, long ago, in the early history of Shadowhunters, there were huge demons that threatened the Earth. Much bigger than any demon we have now, save what greater demons can sometimes become. In that time, it was possible for Shadowhunters to become true Nephilim. Giants on the Earth. I have old woodcuts and drawings of them, and the writings of those who saw them battling demons. He took a piece of paper from his pocket and read aloud.
The land that we have gone through as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people that we saw in it are of great size. There we saw the Nephilim, and to ourselves we seemed like grasshoppers. And so we seem to them.
But this is history, said Julian. People don't turn into giants now.
A land that devours its inhabitants.
Emma could not help but think of Thule and the stories of giants there.
Most did not survive their transformations, said Jem. It was the ultimate sacrifice, to blaze up with heavenly fire and die destroying demons. But it was noticed that many who survived were Parabatai. Shadowhunters were more likely to live through the transformation if they had a Parabatai who did not transform, anchoring them to Earth.
But we both transformed, said Emma. You understand, Jem said, that for years we have tried to understand the Parabatai curse and what it might be. But we certainly never tied it into the time of Nephilim. The end of the time of Nephilim came when the giant demon ceased to come to Earth.
We don't know why they disappeared. They simply did. Perhaps they were all slain. Perhaps they lost interest in this world. Perhaps they feared the Nephilim. This was 800 years ago, and many records have been lost.
So when we turned into giants, said Julian, looking as if the words made him ill, you realized the Parabatai curse was tied to Nephilim somehow.
After the battle, we raced to turn up every record of the true Nephilim.
In doing so, I discovered one tale of a terrible event. A shadow hunter became a true Nephilim to battle a demon. Their Parabatai was meant to stay behind as an anchor, but instead, they too transformed uncontrollably. Both went wild.
They slaughtered the demon. And then they murdered their families and all those who tried to stop them, until they burned alive from the heavenly fire.
He paused.
They were a married couple.
In those days there was no law against loving your Parabatai. Some months later it happened again, this time with another pair of lovers.
And people didn't know about this? Said Emma.
Much was done to cover it up. The practice of Parabatai is one of the most powerful tools the Shadow Hunters possess. No one wanted to lose it. And since the great demons had vanished,
It was not thought that there would be a need to employ true Nephilim again. Indeed, no one ever has, and the method by which true Nephilim were made has been lost. It could have ended there, and indeed there were no records in the Silent City of what happened. But Tessa was able to find an archive in the Spiral Labyrinth. It was a tale of two shadow hunters who became like warlocks, powerful magicians, whose runes were unlike others. They razed a peaceful town to the ground before they were burned to death. But I suspect they were not burned to death by the townspeople. I suspect they died from the heavenly fire. He paused. Not long after the date of this tale, the law was passed that no Parabatai could fall in love. That's suspicious, muttered Emma.
So what you're saying, said Julian, is that the Shadow Hunters destroy their own records of why they created the law about Parabatai love being forbidden? They were afraid that people would take advantage of the power, but they valued the benefits of Parabatai too much to give up the ritual?
That is what I suspect, said Jem. Though I do not think we will be able to prove it.
This can't keep happening, said Emma. We need to tell everyone the truth.
The truth won't stop it happening, said Julian. He looked at her steadily. I would have fallen in love with you, even if I had known exactly what the danger was. Emma's heart seemed to trip over itself. She tried to keep her voice steady. But if the horrible punishments were taken away, she said, if people didn't think they'd lose their families, they'll come forward. Mercy is better than revenge, isn't it?
The Silent Brothers have conferred and agree with you, said Jem. They will make a recommendation to the consul and the new inquisitor when he or she is appointed.
But Gia?
Gia still is the consul, said Emma.
Yes, though she is very ill. She has been for some time. I hope that she will now have the time and space to rest and get well.
Oh. Emma was surprised. Gia had seemed invulnerable to her.
The cohort members who survived are being held in the guard prison. You did win the battle for us, after all, though I would not recommend trying that tactic again.
What's going to happen to us? Julian said. Will we be punished?
For what happened on the field, I do not think so, said Jem.
It was a war. You slew the Riders of Menon, for which everyone is grateful, and you slew several cohort members, which you might have done anyway. I think you'll be curiosities now. True Nephilim have not been seen in centuries. Also, you may have to do community service.
Really? Said Emma.
Not really, said Jem, and winked at her.
I meant about the Parabatai thing, said Julian. We're still breaking the law by feeling like we do about each other. Even if they make the laws gentler, we'll still have to be separated, exiled even, so this never happens again.
Ah, said Jem, and he leaned back against the wall, his arms folded.
When your clothes were cut from you so you could be healed here in the Basilius, it was noticed that your Parabatai runes had disappeared.
Emma and Julian both stared at him.
Now, a Parabatai rune can be cut from your skin, and you will not lose your bond, said Jem. The rune is the symbol, not the bond itself. But it was curious, because there were no marks or scars where your Parabatai runes had been. It was as if they had never been drawn.
The Silent Brothers looked into your minds, and saw the bond had been severed. He paused. In most cases, I would feel I was giving you bad news, but in this case, perhaps not. You are no longer Parabatai. Neither of them moved or even breathed. Inside Emma's chest, her heart seemed to be ringing like a bell in a vast space. The deep echo of a cavern whose roof was so high, all sound vanished into silence and dreams. Julian's face was as white as the demon towers. Not Parabatai, he said at last, his voice like a stranger's.
I'll give you two a moment to digest the news, Jem said, a smile curling at the edge of his mouth. I will go to speak with your family. They have been worried about you.
He left the room, and even though he wore jeans and a sweater, the shadow of robes seemed to move about him as he went. The door closed behind Jem, and still Emma couldn't move. The terror of letting herself believe that the horror was over, that it would be all right, kept her frozen in place. For so long she had lived with the weight on her shoulders. For so long it had been the first thing she'd thought of when she woke up, and the last of her thoughts before she slept. The food of nightmares, and the close of every secret fear.
I will lose Julian. I will lose my family. I will lose myself.
Even in the brightest moments, she had thought she would lose one of those things. She had never dreamed she would keep them all. Emma, Julian said. He had gotten to his feet, limping slightly, and Emma's heart broke. She knew this could be no easier for him than it was for her. She rose to her feet, her legs shaking. They faced each other across the space between their two cots. She didn't know who broke or moved first. It could have been her or him. They could have moved in unison as they had done for so long, still connected even though the parabatai bond was gone. They collided in the middle of the room. She flung her arms around Julian, her bandaged fingers digging into the back of his shirt. He was here. Really here. Solid in her arms. He kissed her face feverishly and ran his hands through her hair. She knew tears were running down her face. She held on to him as tightly as she could, feeling him shaking in her arms. Emma, he was saying over and over, his voice breaking, shattering on the word. Emma, Emma, my Emma. She couldn't speak. Instead, she traced her fingers clumsily across his back, writing out what she couldn't say aloud, as they had for so long. A-T-L-A-S-T, she wrote. A-T-L-A-S-T. The door flew open, and for the first time ever, they didn't leap apart. They kept hold of each other's hands, even as their family and friends poured into the room, tearful and bright with happiness and relief.
They are quite afraid of you in Faerie now, Christina, said Kieran. They call you a slayer of kings and princes. A terrifying shadow hunter. The three of them, Mark, Christina, and Kieran, were sitting by a dry fountain in Angel Square, outside the Basilius. Christina sat between Mark's legs, his arms around her. Kieran leaned against his side.
I'm not terrifying, Christina protested.
You terrify me, Mark said, and Christina turned and made a face at him. Kieran smiled, but did not laugh. There seemed too much tension in him. Perhaps it was because it was difficult for him to be in Alicante. It had been heavily fairy-proof during the Dark War, iron and salt and rowan strategically deployed in nearly every street. The Basilius was covered in hammered iron nails, so Mark and Christina waited for news of Jules and Emma in the square with Kieran, letting the bright sun warm them as they rested. After the Dark War, Mark knew this square had been full of bodies. Corpses lay out in rows, their eyes bound with white silk, ready for burning and burial. Now it was peacefully quiet. There had been deaths in the battle 3 days before, and the next day a great funeral at the fields. Gia had spoken of the sorrow endured, of the necessity of building again and the importance of not acting in revenge against the cohort, 50 of whom were now in the guard jail.
My mother is the one who is terrifying, said Christina, shaking her head.
She was warm in Mark's arms, and Kieran was a comforting weight against his side. If it had not been for worry over Emma and Jules, he would have been perfectly happy.
I told her about us last night.
You did? Mark was agog. Christina's mother was terrifying. He'd heard that after the gates of the city had been opened by the Silent Brothers, she'd climbed up on one of the walls and thrown dozens of spears at the Unseelie fairies with a deadly precision that had sent redcaps scurrying away from the city. There was also a rumor that she'd punched Laszlo Balog in the face, but he decided not to confirm it.
What did she say?
Kieran's black and silver eyes were worried.
She said that it was perhaps not the choice she would have made for me, said Christina. But that what mattered was that I was happy.
She also said she wasn't surprised it took two men to fill Diego's shoes. She grinned.
Because Diego saved my life, I will absorb that slight without retort, said Kieran.
And I'll tie his shoelaces together the next time I see him, said Mark. Can you believe they found Manuel hiding under Horace's dead body?
I'm only surprised he did not cut Horace's body open and hide inside it, said Kieran, dourly.
Mark punched him lightly in the shoulder.
Why did you strike me? Kieran protested. It has been done in Faerie before. Once a cowardly warrior hid inside a kelpie for a week.
Something white fluttered down from the sky, a moth, who deposited an acorn in Kieran's lap and winged away.
A message, Mark said.
Kieran unscrewed the acorn's top. He looked darkly serious, probably because he was now clad in the raiment of an unseelie king. It still gave Mark a jolt to see him, all in black, black boots, black breeches, and a black waistcoat, sewed with embroidered waves of gold and green to symbolize Kieran's Nixie heritage.
From Winter, Kieran said. All the shadow hunters and downworlders are now returned from the unseelie lands to their homes.
Kieran had opened the hospitality of the unseelie court to those who fled the battle on the fields. Alec had said he thought the gesture would go a long way toward rolling back the laws of the Cold Peace. A meeting to discuss how the Clave would go forward was scheduled for the next day, and Mark was anxious for it. Kieran had not stayed long in the unseelie court. He had returned to Mark and Christina the day after the battle, and they had been glad to have him back.
Look, Christina cried.
She sat up, pointing. One of the windows of the Basilius had opened, and Drew had poked her head out. She was waving down at them, gesturing for them to come inside.
Emma and Julian are awake, she called. Come up!
Christina scrambled to her feet, and the others followed.
Julian and Emma.
And Drew had been smiling. Now, Mark thought, now he was perfectly happy. He started toward the Basilius, Christina beside him. They were nearly there when they realized Kieran hadn't followed. Mark turned.
Kieran? He frowned. Is the iron too difficult?
It's not that, Kieran said. I shall return to Faerie.
Now?
Christina said. Now and forever, said Kieran. I shall not come back from there.
What?
Mark strode back toward Kieran. The white letter from Winter fluttered in Kieran's hand like the wing of a bird.
Speak sense, Kieran.
I am speaking sense, Kieran said softly.
Now that we know Emma and Julian will live, I must go back to Faerie. It is the bargain I made with Winter.
He glanced down at the letter. My general summons me. Without a king, the land is at risk of falling into chaos.
They have a king,
Christina had run to Kieran's side. She wore a light blue shawl. She drew it around herself tightly in agitation, shaking her head.
You are their king, whether you are there or here.
No, Kieran closed his eyes. The king is linked to the land. Every moment the king is in the mortal world, the land weakens. I cannot stay here. I did not want to be king. I did not ask to be king, but I am king. And I cannot be a bad one. It would not be right.
Well, we could come with you then, said Mark. We could not stay in Faerie all the time, but we could visit.
I thought that as well. But even after a short time as king in the court. I know otherwise now, Kieran said. His hair had gone entirely black under the slim gold circlet that now encircled his brow. The king is not permitted to have a mortal consort.
We know that,
said Christina, remembering her words in Brosland. Even then, she had believed Kieran might not become king, that a way would be found.
But your father had mortal consorts, didn't he? Isn't there some way around the rules?
No, he had mortal lovers. The word sounded ugly. A consort is an official position. Mortal companions are playthings to be toyed with and
tossed aside. He cared not about how they were treated. But I do care. If I brought you to court as such, you would be treated with contempt and cruelty, and I could not stand to see it.
You are the king, Christina said. They're your people. Can't you order them not to be cruel?
They've had years of a cruel reign, said Kieran. I cannot teach them overnight. I did not know it myself. I had to learn kindness from both of you. His eyes glittered.
My heart is breaking, and I cannot see a way out. You are all I want, but I must do what is best for my people. I cannot weaken my land by coming here, and I cannot hurt you by bringing you there. We would never have peace in either place.
Please, Kieran, said Mark. He caught at Kieran's wrist. I am holding the arm of the Unseelie King, he thought. It was perhaps the first time he thought of Kieran as the king, and not simply his Kieran. We could find a solution.
Kieran pulled Mark to him and kissed him, hard and suddenly, his fingers digging into Mark's wrist. When he let him go, he was pale, his cheeks burning with color.
I have not slept for 3 days. This is why I wanted Adean to be king. Others want the throne. I do not. I only want you.
And you will be a great king because of it, said Christina, her brown eyes glimmering with unshed tears. What if it was only you and Mark? Mark is half fairy. Surely that must mean something.
He is a shadow hunter to them, said Kieran, releasing Mark's hand. He strode over to Christina. His eyes were smudged with tiredness.
And I love you both, my brave Christina. Nothing can change that. Nothing ever will.
The tears she had been holding back spilled down her cheeks as Kieran cupped her face gently.
You are truly leaving? There must be another way.
There is no other way.
Kieran kissed her swiftly and hard as he had kissed Mark. Christina closed her eyes.
Know that I will always love you, no matter how far away I am.
He let her go. Mark wanted to protest, but more than Christina, he understood the cruel realities of fairy, the thorns among the roses, what it would mean to be a toy and plaything of the king of a fairy court. He could stand it for himself, but not for Christina.
Kieran leapt onto Windspear's back. Be happy with each other, he said, his eyes averted as if he could not bear to look at them. It is my wish, as king.
Kieran, Mark said.
But Kieran was already riding away with thunderous speed. The flagstones trembled with Windspear's retreating hoofbeats. Within seconds, Kieran was out of sight.
Kit hated it in the Silent City. Even though his room was fairly comfortable, at least compared to the rest of the Silent City, which was all sharp-edged objects made out of human skeletons. Once you'd picked up 3 or 4 skulls and muttered, "Alas, poor Yorick," to them, the novelty wore off quickly. He suspected his rooms were a Silent Brothers' chambers. There were a lot of books on a wooden shelf, all of them about history and glorious battles. There was a comfortable bed and a bathroom down the hall. Not that he wanted to think about the bathroom conditions in the Silent City. He hoped to forget them as soon as possible. He had been left with little to do but heal and think about what had happened on the battlefield. He remembered, over and over, the surge of power that had gone through him when he'd struck the riders and made their horses disappear.
Was it dark magic? Was that why he was locked up? And how was it possible he had fairy blood?
He could touch iron and rowan wood. He'd lived his whole life surrounded by technology. He didn't look anything like a fairy, and no one in the Shadow Market had ever whispered at the possibility. It was more than enough to occupy his mind and keep him from thinking about Ty. At least it should have been. He was lying on the bed, staring at the stone ceiling, when he heard footsteps approaching in the hallway outside his room. His first thought was food. A Silent Brother brought him a tray of plain, nourishingly boring food 3 times a day. But the footsteps clicked on the stone. Heels.
he frowned. The consul? Diana, even? He'd play it cool and explain he hadn't done anything wrong.
He sat up, running his fingers through his hair, and wondering how the Silent Brothers ever got anything done without owning mirrors. How did they know their robes weren't on backward? The door opened, and Tessa Gray came in. She wore a green dress and a hairband like Alice in Wonderland. She smiled at him affectionately.
"Please break me out of here," said Kit. "I don't want to be trapped in here forever. I didn't do anything wrong, especially not any necromancy."
Tessa's smile faded. She came over to sit down at the foot of the bed, her gray eyes worried.
"So much for playing it cool," Kit thought. "Christopher," she said, "I'm sorry for having left you here for so long."
"It's all right," he said, though he wasn't sure it was.
"But don't call me Christopher. No one does."
"Kit," she said,
"I'm so sorry that we left you here. We were looking after Julian and Emma, so we couldn't leave the city. It was touch and go for a while, but they just woke up." She smiled. "I thought you'd want to know."
Kit was glad to hear it, and yet...
"What about the others? Are they okay? What about Ty?"
"Ty and the others are fine. And Emma is all right in part thanks to you. You saved her life." Kit slumped back against the metal headboard of the bed, relief coursing through him.
"So I'm not in trouble for what I did on the battlefield?"
"No," Tessa said slowly. "But you need to know what it means. There's a story. One shrouded in mystery and misdirection. One that very few people alive know."
"Something about fairy blood," Kit said.
"The writer," he said, "Kit is the child, the descendant of the first heir. But I don't see how that would be possible."
Tessa smoothed her skirt over her legs. "Long ago, the King of Unseelie and the Seelie Queen formed an alliance to unite the fairy courts. They brought magicians from all over fairy to cast spells, ensuring that the child they had would be the perfect heir. Not all the magic was good magic. Some of it was dark. The king dreamed of a son who would unite the realms, inspire perfect loyalty and perfect love, who would be braver than any fairy knight that had ever gone before."
"Sure sounds like me," muttered Kit. Tessa flashed him a sympathetic smile.
"But when the child was born, she was a girl. Oraline."
"Plot twist," said Kit.
"The king had expected a male heir and was upset. In his eyes, the child was flawed, and eventually he set a fairy knight the task of having her killed, though the king had the tale put around that she had been kidnapped, and that is the story most believe."
"The king planned to kill his own daughter?"
"Indeed. And he has had every daughter of his killed since, in bitterness over Oraline. For she defied him. She was still the heir. She called upon the knight's loyalty to her, and he let her go. That is what the king tried to hide. He pretended Oraline's death was the fault of another, even when Oraline fled to the mortal world. There she met a magician who became her husband, a magician who was descended from the line of shadow hunters who had left the clave."
"The Lost Herondales," Kit guessed.
"Correct. They were your ancestors. Their line led to your mother. Through all the decades, the Unseelie King has hunted those he thought were descended from his daughter. And so the Herondales have hidden, concealed by false names and powerful magic."
"Why would the king do that?" said Kit.
"Oraline inherited a great deal of magic. The spells done on her before and after she was born were powerful. She is called the first heir because she was the first fairy born who was the heir to the Seelie and Unseelie court both. And so are all her descendants. Your blood gives you claim to the high kingship of fairy."
"What?" said Kit. "But I don't want it. I don't want to be high king of fairy."
"It doesn't matter what you want, not to them,"
Tessa said sadly. Even if you never went near the throne of Faerie, there are warring factions who would love to get hold of you and use you as a pawn. An army with you at the head of it could take down the king or queen or both. Goosebumps flooded along Kit's arms.
But doesn't everyone know who I am now? Because of what happened with the riders? Are they hunting me?
Tessa put her hand on his wrist. It was a gentle motherly touch. Kit could not remember such a touch in all his life. Only the memory of light blonde hair and the sound of a lilting voice singing to him. The story that I love you, it has no end.
Part of the reason we kept you here these last few days was to reach out into Downworld to see if anyone has been talking about you, said Tessa.
We have many connections, many ways of following gossip in the markets. But with the chaos of the battle, all the talk is of the death of the riders, what happened with Emma and Julian, and Kieran's ascension. There have been words of a warlock who made the great horses of the riders vanish, but we have spread the word that it was Ragnar Fell. She rolled her eyes. I thought his name was Ragnar Shade.
It is Ragnar Fell,
she said, and smiled in a way that made her look 19.
He is a scamp, and has been in hiding for some years. He resurfaced in grand style during the battle, and now everyone knows Ragnar Fell is back, and that he defeated the riders to boot. She chuckled. He will be insufferable.
He didn't actually do it, said Kit.
That will not make a difference to Ragnar, said Tessa gravely.
So, I'm safe, Kit said. I could go back to the Institute in Los Angeles?
I don't know.
A line of worry had appeared between Tessa's brows.
We felt nervous enough before leaving you, even with you in the Institute and Ragnar nearby to protect you. He even followed you when you went to the Shadow Market.
Did he say why we were going to the Shadow Market? Kit said, forgetting in his sudden fear for Ty not to act suspicious.
Of course not, said Tessa. He wasn't there to tattle on you, just protect you.
She patted his shoulder absently while Kit mused on the strange loyalty of people you barely knew.
The thing is, before, we didn't realize you'd manifest any of the powers of the air. Few of your ancestors have before, save Auraline. We thought if we kept you away from things that might trigger the powers.
No fairies, Kit recalled. No battles.
Exactly. If it happens again, word might spread. Besides, fairies have long memories, and we want to make you as safe as possible.
Does that mean leaving me in the Silent City? Because I don't like it here, Kit said. I'm not good at silent, and I don't want to talk about the bathroom situation.
No, Tessa said. She took a deep breath, and Kit realized she was actually nervous. What I'm saying is that you should come and live with me and Jem and the child we're going to have. After all our wandering, we've decided to settle down and build a home. We want you to build it with us, to be part of our family. Kit was almost too stunned to speak. Not the least at the revelation that Tessa was pregnant. But why?
Tessa looked at him forthrightly.
Because a long time ago the Herondales gave both Jem and me a home, and we want to do the same for you.
But am I actually a Herondale? He asked. I thought my father was a Herondale and my mother was a mundane, but it looks like they were both Shadow Hunters. So I don't even know what my name should be.
Your father's real name isn't known, Tessa said. He did have a small amount of Shadow Hunter blood. It allowed him to have the sight.
I thought Shadow Hunter blood bred true.
It does. But over the course of many generations, it can become diluted. Still, your father could have trained and ascended had he wanted. He never did. It was your mother who bore runes. It was your mother who made you the lost Herondale we searched for so long. It is your choice, of course. You can bear any name you wish. We would still welcome you in our family, whether you were called Kit Herondale or not. Kit thought of Jace,
and of the mother he had never known, who he remembered now only in the songs she had sung him once, the mother who had given up her own life for his. "I'll be a Herondale," he said. "I like the family ring. It's classy."
Tessa smiled at him.
"Anyway," Kit said, "where are you planning to live?"
"Jem owns a house in Devon, a big old pile. We'll be going there. We know you care about the Blackthorns, so we'll understand if you want to stay with them," she added quickly.
"We would be sad, but we would do whatever we can to protect you. Ragnar would help, and Katarina. We'd have to tell the Blackthorns why you needed the protection, of course."
She was still talking, but Kit had stopped hearing her. The words spilled around him in a meaningless rush as all the memories he'd been trying to push back flew at him like sharply pecking birds. The Institute, the beach, the Blackthorns, always kind to him. Emma saving his life. Julian driving him to the market and listening to him talk about Ty. Even then, he'd wanted to talk about Ty. All his energy had gone into Ty, all his devotion and hopes for the future. He liked the other Blackthorns, but he hardly knew them well. He probably knew Drew the best and liked her as a friend, but that was a small thing compared to the burning hurt and humiliation he felt when he thought about Ty. He didn't blame Ty for what had happened. He blamed himself. He'd been too fixated on not losing Ty to tell him what he needed to hear. Everyone needed to be stopped from making bad choices sometimes, but he hadn't stopped Ty. And he'd gotten what he deserved, really. Now that he knew he meant nothing much to Ty, how could he live in the Institute again? See him every day. Feel like an idiot constantly. Feel the pity of his family. Listen to them tell him he should try to make other friends. Survive in the same house with Ty while Ty avoided him. There was no real question about it. "I can't face going back there and living with him. This is my chance to start again and learn what it means to be who I am." "I'll go with you. I'd like to live with you," Kit said.
"Oh," Tessa blinked.
"Oh." She grabbed his hand and squeezed it, smiling all over her kind face.
"That's lovely, Kit. That's wonderful. Jem will be so happy, too. And it'll be wonderful for the baby to have company. I mean, hopefully you'll like the baby as well."
She blushed. Kit thought it would actually be kind of nice to have a small sibling-type person in his life, but he said nothing.
"I'm babbling," Tessa said. "I'm just so excited. We'll go tonight. Get you safe and settled as fast as possible. We'll arrange for you to have a tutor for all the necessary protection spells to be done by the Silent Brothers."
"That sounds good," Kit said, a little exhausted already by the thought of everything that needed to be done. "I only have this bag, no other luggage." It was true, and there was nothing he cared about much in the bag either, besides the Herondale dagger and the witchlight Ty had given him.
"I imagine you'd like to say goodbye to the Blackthorns before we go."
"No," Kit said. "I don't want to see them."
Tessa blinked.
"It's better if they don't know all about this first air stuff," Kit said. "It's safer for them. Jem can tell them I just decided L.A. wasn't for me. They're all so far ahead of me in training, and I should learn from the beginning if I want to be a shadow hunter."
Tessa nodded. Kit knew she didn't entirely buy this excuse, but she also knew enough not to pry. It was very reassuring.
"I do have one question before we go," Kit said, and Tessa looked at him curiously.
"Will I be growing pointy ears? Maybe a tail? I've seen some weird-looking fairies in the shadow market."
Tessa grinned. "I guess we'll find out." Everyone wanted to come by the canal house and say hello to Emma and Julian, now that they had left the Basilius. People Drew was familiar with, as well as people she wasn't, flooded into the ground floor, bringing flowers and small gifts. New gauntlets for Emma, a gear jacket for Julian. Some were overly bright and cheery and greeted Emma and Julian as if nothing odd had happened to them at all. Some complimented them as if they thought the whole becoming enormous and almost dying was part of a predetermined plan that had paid off nicely. Others were awkward,
those who had been a little too close to the cohort, Drew suspected, as if they wondered if Emma and Julian might grow huge at any moment and squash them right there in the kitchen. One kindly older lady complimented Julian on being tall, and a terrible silence fell. Tavi said, "What's going on?" and Drew had to drag him into the sitting room. A few others seemed to have had major life experiences.
"It just came to me on the field that I should spend more time with my family," said Trini Castell. "Moments of peace are precious moments. We'll never get them back."
"So true," said Julian. He looked as if he were trying not to laugh. Everyone else nodded thoughtfully. It was very strange. For days, Drew had been worried that Emma and Julian would be punished in some way when they woke up, either officially by the Clave or by the ignorant judgment of other shadow hunters, but it didn't seem to be happening. She edged closer to Magnus, who was sitting by the fire, eating the chocolates out of a box someone had brought for Emma. He'd come over with Maris, Max, and Rafe so they could play with Tavi. Alec, Jace, and Clary were coming later, apparently with some sort of surprise. Isabel and Simon had already returned to the New York Institute to keep an eye on things.
"Why aren't people mad?" she whispered, "at Emma and Julian."
Magnus wiggled his eyebrows at her. Magnus had very amusing eyebrows. Drew had always found him an amusing person generally, with his immense tallness and refusal to take anything seriously. "Well," Magnus said, "without Julian's war council and his strategy for dealing with Dearborn, it's likely that the cohort would have prevailed. The road the cohort was traveling led to civil war and bloodshed. Everyone is glad it was avoided."
"True," said Drusilla. "But that was before they became giant angel monsters."
"Angels are messengers." Magnus dusted cocoa powder off his hands, looking thoughtful. "They speak in strange ways, even to you, their children. Horus and his cohort spoke as if they were doing the angels' will, and because of it people feared them. On the battlefield, burning with heavenly fire, Julian and Emma proved that wasn't the case. The angels spoke through them."
"So basically everyone who didn't like Horus wanted a big angel to squash the cohort," Drew said.
Magnus grinned. "They don't want to say that, but believe me, it was immensely satisfying to them." At that moment, Jason Clary arrived with Alec and an enormous cake they'd iced themselves. Most of the strangers had already departed, and Ty helped them put it on the sideboard, where the cake box was open to reveal that the lettering said, "Congratulations on not being giants anymore." Everyone laughed and gathered around to cut pieces of lemon chocolate cake. Julian and Emma leaned against each other, their shoulders touching. Since they had returned from the Basileus, it had seemed that a massive weight was off Julian's shoulders. He seemed lighter and happier than he had since before the Dark War. Drew knew that he and Emma were no longer Parabatai. The angel magic had burned it out of them somehow. It didn't take a genius to figure out that they were probably very pleased about that, considering all the smiling and hand-touching they were doing. Mark and Christina, on the other hand, seemed sad. They were quiet among all the bright chatter in the room. At one point, Drew saw Emma take Christina into the kitchen and hug her as if something bad had happened. Drew didn't know what it was, but she did notice that Kieran wasn't there. Ty was also quiet. Every time he passed Julian, Jules would pull him in for a hug and ruffle his hair the way he liked when he was little. Ty would smile, but he seemed unusually listless, uninterested in even eavesdropping on the guests' conversations and making notes for his detective manuals the way he usually did. Eventually he went up to Magnus, who was sitting in a deep blue chair by the fireplace, holding his deep blue son on his lap and tickling him. Drew edged closer to the hearth, wondering what Ty wanted to say to the warlock.
"Where's Kit, really?" Ty said. And Drew thought, "I should have known."
Jem had told them that Kit was coming to live with him and Tessa and Devon, but not why, or why they had to leave in such a hurry. Julian and the others seemed to think Kit would visit them soon, but Drew wasn't so sure.
"I keep asking, but no one will tell me."
Magnus looked up, his cat eyes hooded. "Kit's all right. He's with Tessa and Jem. He's going to be living with them."
"I know," Ty said.
His voice shook. I know, but can I say goodbye to him? If I could just talk to him once.
He's already gone, Magnus.